So in that passage that Chris just read for us, Jesus is in the garden with his closest friends, and he's about to go die. And I know that's something that here at a church and here at Providence we talk about a lot. And one of the reasons I know we talk about it a lot is because when I'm back there with the kids most weeks and I'm teaching, anytime I say the name Jesus back with the kindergarten through second class, anytime I say Jesus, every time a kid will raise their hand, usually without even me asking a question, they like to just offer information whenever possible, but a kid will raise their hand and I'll call on them and they'll say Jesus, and I'll say, yeah, Jesus, and they'll say, Jesus died for me. And I say, yes, that's right, Jesus died for you. And I think that's good. I think it's good that we know that Jesus died for us, and I think it's good that our children know that, but I think it's become such a part of our language and such a part of our beliefs that we forget that Jesus died for us. Because see, we know the end of the story. We know that 3 days later, Jesus rose again. We know why Jesus died. We know Jesus died for us, and we're so grateful for that. But I think so often we forget that Jesus, this man who lived for 30 years, who had a family, who had friends, more than that, he had followers who had these expectations of him that had been talked about for thousands of years, was killed by his own people. And here in the garden, I think Jesus is dealing with that fact, with this death, and he tells his friends, he tells his disciples, I'm sorrowful unto death. He's feeling these emotions of walking towards death, and I think we miss this. I think because we talk about it so much, we forget about the emotion of death when we talk about Jesus. Because let me tell you, when I watch the movie Lion King, I've seen that movie hundreds of times, and I love that movie, and I watch it. But sometimes I feel more emotion when I see Mufasa die than when I read the Bible and I see Jesus die. I think it's because by the time we get to Matthew chapter 26, by the time we see Jesus in Gethsemane, we know what's about to happen, and so we start to skim a little bit, and we start to read a little bit faster, get to that point that we know that's happening, so we can see what we think is the whole point of all of this, and what is. Jesus came to die, but Jesus also lived for these 30 years, and Jesus did all these things, and he had all these people around him, and I think we miss that a lot of times, and that's what I want to talk about today, because if we read this passage in Matthew, it is about Jesus. Jesus is the main character here. But at the same time, it's not totally about only Jesus. Because if Matthew wanted to write just about Jesus in this passage right here, he could have done it like John. At this point in John's gospel, he gives us a whole chapter on the prayer of Jesus. And it's really focused on that. Or he could have written it like Luke. Luke tells us more about what Jesus prayed. Luke tells us about Jesus sweating drops of blood and about an angel coming to strengthening him. But Matthew doesn't do that. Matthew gives us this pattern of three. And if you're ever reading the Bible or reading any book or watching a movie or anything like that, and something happens three times back to back to back like this, you should pause and pay attention because it's going to be important. And this threefold structure that Matthew gives us here is between Jesus and his friends, Jesus and his followers. And it's not a good pattern. Because I think something else we forget about this point is that when we think back about Jesus, we see Jesus as a victorious Son of God who came to save us and who did. And we think about the victories of Jesus and the great teachings of Jesus. But I think we forget about the relationships of Jesus. Because yes, Jesus has, at this point, 11 friends here with him. 11 of his closest friends. But all throughout the Gospels, we see over and over a crowd gathering around Jesus and him having this opportunity to really have all these people close to him. And then every time, the people abandon him and the people walk away. We see Jesus preaching in his own country, in Galilee, where he's from, these people who watched him grow up, and Jesus finally steps forward into the synagogue and says, Isaiah was talking about me. I'm the one you've been waiting for all this time. And the people try to kill him, and so he has to leave the place where he grew up. And then as he's going throughout the Gospels, John tells us about it, about these people who come to Jesus and say, Jesus, I want to follow you. I want to follow you and I want to be with you. And Jesus says, it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be fun. And the people say, never mind, and they walk away. And here in this passage that Chris read for us, we see Jesus grieved unto death, sorrowful unto death, this deep, deep emotion. And he tells the only friends he's got left, the only people left there with him, he tells them, I am sorrowful unto death. Pray with me, please. Just help me through this. Pray with me as I pray. And his closest friends in his hour of need fall asleep. Those last people that he had left around him fell asleep and abandoned him in that very last moment. I think this is what Matthew's showing us here. And the thing that makes me so upset about this is that it'd be one thing if Jesus just walked away into that garden and didn't say anything to the disciples. But he tells them, he says to them, I am sorrowful unto death. He has told them time and time again, I am going to die. You are all going to abandon me. And the disciples keep saying, no, not us. No. You don't know what's happening. You're the Messiah. You're going to have a kingdom on this world. It's going to be fine. And Jesus is saying, no, that's not what's going to happen. And here in this moment of need, he turns to his closest friends, the people he should be able to depend on, and they let him down one last time. And here we know that as we keep reading this story, that it doesn't get much better as Jesus goes to the cross. We have that story of Peter denying Jesus three times. And that's the only one who's there. That's the only person who's there. In John's gospel, John is there at the cross, but no one else is. Everybody else has walked away because they're ashamed, because they don't know what's going on, and Jesus is alone to die. And the reason why I think this is so important is because I'm afraid that we're doing the same thing in a lot of ways. Because like I said, I think this passage is about Jesus, but I think it's more about the relationship. I think it's more about that emotion and the relationship between the disciples and Jesus, between these friends. And I'm afraid that we as a church do this all too often. I'm afraid that people come to us and they say, I'm grieved unto death. I'm afraid they come to us and they tell us the things that are wrong. And I'm afraid that we fall asleep, that we don't help them out, or that we think that we're helping them out, but we're really not doing much at all. Or maybe we're not even awake. Maybe people are knocking on our doors and we're just sleeping as they stand outside waiting for someone to come help them. And so that's what I want to talk about, is I want to talk about how the church can react to this. And when I say the church, I think we do something sometimes that's really dangerous. I think that at times when I say the church, and when we hear people talk about the church, we think of the church as an institution. And I know that we say all the time that the church isn't the building, it's the people in it, and I think we all understand that, but I think when I say the church, a lot of the times we think, oh, so if someone needs something, I can just send them to the church. I can just send them to someone else, somewhere higher up in the church, and they'll take care of it. It's not really my job. I have another job. I'll send it to the pastor, or I'll send it to the church. But when I say the church, what I really mean is you. And what I really mean is me. And when I say you, I'm not using a collective you to say all of us, but I'm saying you individually. Each and every one of us in this room has responsibilities. And when someone comes to us, I think there are things that we should do for them. And so the first thing that I think that we do all too often is I think, like I said, I think we fall asleep. And I think we can see this especially in the way that a lot of things happen now on social media. And I think social media is a great thing, and please don't hear me saying anything negative about social media as a whole, but there's something that's kind of come up that goes by different names, but hashtag activism. And I'm sure you guys have heard of this, and I think the most popular example that you can probably think of is the Ice Bucket Challenge. Do you guys remember the Ice Bucket Challenge from a couple years ago? The thing where it was for ALS research, and you would go and you would dump a bucket of ice water on yourself, and then you would challenge three friends to do it, and you would donate $10, or if you wouldn't do it, you would donate $100. And that ad campaign, that activism, raised a lot of money for ALS, and it was great. And social media did a lot for ALS research. The thing is I don't know how many of you participated in that. I don't know how many of you dumped a bucket of ice water on yourself. But think about it. If you did do that, or if you did see that on Facebook and you thought it was good, ask yourself now, how is ALS research doing? A couple years ago, everybody was so concerned about it, and it was this thing that was so present in our minds and was all over our news feeds on Facebook and all over our culture. But how's it going now? And I think we can see this time and time again, these different causes come up, and everybody's talking about them for 3 days, and they raise a lot of money, and it's great. And then we fall back asleep because it goes across our radar, and it passes on, and we move on to the next big thing. And there are some people who argue this is a good thing because it raises a lot of money in one bunch, but I think that at the same time, we got to be careful because we let it go on and we never really talk about it again. And I think we can see this with a lot of different things, and I think another problem that we do with falling asleep is something that Dietrich Bonhoeffer talks about. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a pastor in the early 1900s in Germany. And he was one of the only and one of the loudest voices, Christian voices, that spoke out against Hitler and the Nazi Party in Germany. He was eventually imprisoned, then sent to a concentration camp, and then he was executed just days before the camp was liberated. But one of the things that Bonhoeffer talked about as he looked around at the church in Germany and saw what was going on, because the church in Germany just folded. Hitler came in and said, "This is what you're going to say," and most of the church said, "Okay, yeah, we can do that, no problem. Yep, that's fine." And Bonhoeffer stood up and refused. And one of the things that Bonhoeffer said that was going wrong there in Germany was that people were too concerned with the life to come, and they forgot about the life here and now. And I think this is something that has been happening in Christianity since the beginning. If you look in 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, Paul is writing to the city of Thessalonica, and he's dealing with them about, yes, Jesus is coming back, but that doesn't mean you just sit there and do nothing until that happens. Yes, Jesus is coming back, but you still have work to do now. And I think this happens to us over and over and over again, that we as Christians, once we learn about Jesus and once we learn about heaven and all these great things, we just kind of check out and we say, oh, well, this world isn't my home, so I don't really have to worry about it too much, and I'll just kind of hang out here until I die, and then the good stuff will start then. And I think when we do that, we miss out on so much, because we miss out on the world around us. And we miss out on the pain and the suffering that's going on around us, and we miss opportunities to help them. Because while with things like hashtag activism, I think we're awake, and I think we're alert to issues, and we fall asleep, I think so much more often we never wake up at all. I think so often that we sit here and we don't see at all the things that are going on around us. I think there are people in faraway countries who are suffering, whether it be from hunger and lack of resources, or whether it be from violence. And I think that we're much happier to sit here and not think about it than to deal with what's going on. And I think there are people here in our community, whether it be here at Providence or in Jefferson City or Jefferson County or here at Carson Newman, who are suffering, who are going through hard times, and we don't give them the time of day. Because when we ask them how they're doing, we're just walking by and we don't stop to ask how they're really doing. Or because when they do tell us how they're doing, we then tell them how we're really busy too, and so we hope it works out for them, and we just walk on by. And I think those are the times that we never wake up at all. And so I think that's the first thing we do. I think just like the disciples fell asleep, I think so often we're asleep. But I think there are other times where we're awake, where we start to see the problems around us, and we start to work with those people, and we see the sorrow and the pain around us, and we talk to these people. But we're not out of the woods yet. And to help me illustrate this point, I'm gonna show you a video. You've probably seen this video before. If not, it's a good one, and so we'll watch it, and then we'll talk a little bit about what's going on with it.
It's just, there's all this pressure, you know? And sometimes it feels like it's right up on me, and I can just feel it, like literally feel it in my head, and it's relentless, and I don't know if it's going to stop. I mean, that's the thing that scares me the most, is that I don't know if it's ever going to stop.
Yeah. Well, you do have a nail in your head.
It is not about the nail.
Are you sure? Because, I mean, I'll bet if we got that out of there...
Stop trying to fix it.
No, I'm not trying to fix it. I'm just pointing out that maybe the nail is causing...
You always do this. You always try to fix things when what I really need is for you to just listen.
Yeah, see, I don't think that is what you need. I think what you need is to get the nail
out. See, you're not even listening now.
Okay, fine. I will listen. Fine.
It's just... Sometimes it's like... There's this achy... I don't know what it is. And I'm not sleeping very well at all. And all my sweaters are snagged. I mean, all of them.
Yeah, that sounds really hard.
It is. Thank you. Ow!
Oh, come on. Ow. If you would just...
Don't! Try to see things my way.
Do I have to keep on? Okay, so that's a great video. I don't care what you say, that's a great video. One of my favorite things about that video, before we move on to the other things, is that when that first started coming out and circulating around, Ash and I saw it, and we showed it to my parents, and they laughed, and Ash and I laughed, and I showed it to my sister who's married, and her and her husband laughed, and then I showed it to my other sister who's single, and she said, "What?" And I said, "Get it," because she's like, "I have no," and I was like, "Oh, okay, well, that's fine." But I think this is the church's problem so often. And I think it's really, really difficult for us a lot of the times. Because when I watch that video, I am totally on the guy's side. 100% on the guy's side. I want to just fix the problem and move on. Because that's going to get the nail to the head. The problem's going to be gone. It's going to work. It really is. And when I have these conversations with Ashley so often, I've learned to not always try to take the nail out, and I work really hard to do that. And then sometimes I think about it a little too much, and I think to myself, okay, active listening, active listening, active listening. And then I think, what is active listening? And I think to myself, oh my gosh, I'm just sitting here staring blankly at her. Does she know I'm listening? And then I think, what face do you make when you actively listen? And so then I smile a little bit to show I'm acknowledging, but then I realize she's telling something about her being really angry, and I'm like, oh my gosh, she thinks I'm laughing at her anger. Stop smiling. And so then I frown a little bit, and then she looks confused, and I say, okay, back to blank stare, back to blank stare. And it's just this whole big thing every time. And I think that the church does the same thing. I think people come to us and talk to us, and we say, Have you read the Bible? Here's a verse. Here's a book. Or we say give it to God. We say just trust in God, everything's going to be okay. Or we say, when was the last time you were at church? Or we say, oh, do you see here, you sinned here, and so that's where your pain is coming from. It's from that sin, right? Just don't sin. And I think people say, it's not about the nail. It's just sometimes people just need to be heard and acknowledge that they are in pain and acknowledge their grief. Because I think the church, a lot of times we get really uncomfortable with grief, and we get really uncomfortable with emotion. Because when we see someone who's in this really tough spot, and when we see someone who's grieving, a lot of times we interpret it as not trusting God. And we start to think to ourselves about the fruit of the Spirit, and we say, love, joy, peace, patience, and kindness. And we think to ourselves, if joy is a fruit of the Spirit, that means you shouldn't be sad, so just stop being sad, fruit of the Spirit, and you'll be good to go. And we start giving them all these Christian solutions before we ever acknowledge the fact, hey, you are grieving, you are sorrowful unto death, and I'm here for you. You're grieving, and you have a right to grieve. You're angry, and you have a right to be angry. You're confused, you're lonely, and you have a right to those feelings. Because if Jesus here is feeling sorrow, I think that we too have a right to be sorrowful. Because Jesus is God. Jesus, the fullness of God, was pleased to dwell in Jesus. And Jesus was sorrowful. And so if that's true, then I sure hope that we too can be sorrowful. And I think the interesting thing about what Jesus asks of his closest friends here is he doesn't really talk it through with them. He doesn't tell them exactly what's about to happen step by step and say, what should I do? He just says, you stay here, I'm going to go over here and just watch and pray. I think this fact that the disciples are praying over here and Jesus is praying over here, Jesus just wants them to be with him in his grief. He wants them to pray in solidarity with him. They're not fixing a problem. They're just being there with him in his grief. And the disciples can't do it. They don't get it. They don't know what's going on. They're tired. And Jesus' grief isn't enough to shock them out of that complacency into being there with him. I think when we read Job, it's a complicated book, and there's a lot of stuff going on in there. And I think when we read that book, we put a lot of blame, and sometimes rightfully so, on the friends of Job who say all these things that were like, I don't think that's true. But I think the problem with Job's friends is that they open their mouths, because they're really great friends until they open their mouths. Because if you read Job, the first thing they do is they sit there with Job for 7 days and 7 nights on the ash heap, and no one says a word. For 7 days and 7 nights, they just sit there with one another. And I think we can learn something from that. I think we can learn something about just sitting with someone. Just sitting with someone and saying, you're upset, and that's okay. You're upset, and you have a right to be upset. Because this world isn't pretty. There's so much going on around us, and I think a lot of times we just try to separate ourselves from that and try to not think about all the evil going on, but it's there, and there are people who are affected by it. And we try to tell people, hey, just stop being upset, love God, trust God, and move on. But I think Jesus here is telling us, just be with them for a little bit. The thing about this passage is that it's complicated, because I'm sure as you notice, as Chris read, there are all these things about Jesus telling God, who, like I said a minute ago, in Jesus, the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. That's in Colossians. And yet Jesus says, not my will, but your will. And that's a little weird, because we don't really know what's going on there. And then we have these whole things of Jesus being human, yet being God, and we don't really know what's going on there. And then Jesus says things like, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. We don't really know what's going on there. And then we have Judas coming in to betray Jesus. And some of the Gospels tell us that Satan has entered into Judas. And that's a little bit different. And so many of the commentaries and the different things that I read getting ready for this morning really focused on those things and really focused on that theology. And I think that's important. I think that Trinitarian theology and the Christological controversy of is Jesus God, is Jesus man, is he both, what's going on there, I think those are all important. But that's all kind of on one level. That's all kind of up here ideas. And I think sometimes we focus on those ideas because when we start to get to the ground level stuff dealing with other people, it gets a little bit messy and it's a little bit difficult and we don't like it. So we go back up to that theology. Like Tony said, I'm a student at Carson Newman. I'm a religion student. I'm a senior, and so I'm just about finished up there. Last year, I took a systematic theology class, which is one of my favorite classes. We spent the whole semester just going through some of the most difficult theological conversations I've ever had, just stuff that'll make your head hurt, books that I still don't really know what was happening for most of the book. It was tough stuff. A lot of it was very kind of up-in-the-air theology. But the first day when we walked into this class with a professor that I respect very much, we walked in, there were 26 students and our professor, and we're sitting in this room, and it's kind of in a circle, laid out in a circle. Everybody sits down, and we go over the syllabus and do all the normal things, and then right before we leave, the professor says, take out a piece of paper. So we all take out a piece of paper, and he begins to tell us a story. Tells us a story about a student he had several years ago And he said she was a great student, one of the students that just professors just love to have in their classrooms. She was involved. She was attentive. She was hardworking. And one day, she went to the doctor and was diagnosed with a rare form of cancer. And she had to drop out of school for a little bit. She had to go back home. The cancer was getting worse. The treatments weren't working. So she needed a heart transplant. So she was waiting for that. Finally, the heart transplant came through. She got a heart. The heart took it. Her body didn't reject it. And she was able to come back to school eventually. And he said through all of this, he would talk with her from time to time, and other people talked to her about what was going on. And then when she was finally able to come back to school, everybody was obviously thrilled. Everybody was happy. Everybody was praising God, saying praise be to God that she's healed. And rightfully so. Rightfully so. He said a couple years after that happened, after her heart transplant, her brother, who's a couple years younger than her, was diagnosed with the same form of cancer as her. And within 3 weeks, he had passed away. The professor looked at us in the classroom and he said, "You are a minister. You are a minister to this family. You have just walked up to their house and knocked on their front door. This student, this girl, has opened the door for you, has let you in, and you're sitting on her couch. What do you say to her?" This girl who was just told she was saved by God and then watched her brother die by the same disease. What do you say to her? And so we all wrote down our answers and we talked about it. And the point, though, of all that, the reason we talked about that was because if all we learned about that semester was the Trinity and the Christological controversies and about creation and about eschatology and all of these things, but you don't know how to deal with people like that, then what are we really doing? I think that's a little bit weird for us as a church sometimes, because I think a lot of times the theology is important and we should talk about those things. But I think that we see kind of God's heart in Micah 6 when Micah is talking to the people and delivering the words of the Lord. And God says to the people, "Enough. Enough. Enough with these festivals. Enough with these sacrifices. Enough with going to the temple and doing all these things. Enough. I'm tired of it." And then in Micah 6:8, Micah says to the people, "But what does the Lord require of you? But to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly before your God." God is telling the people, enough with all this theology. Enough with the sacrifices. Enough with these festivals. Enough. Go out there and talk to the people around you and do something about it. There are people around you starving. There are people around you enslaved. There are people around you being slaughtered. And all you're concerned about is making sure you get to church on time. Enough. And I think we get that reverse sometimes. I think sometimes we think, oh, I just need to spend a little bit more time figuring out my theology and then I can go help someone. Oh, I just need to spend a little bit more time reading the Bible and then I can go help someone. I'm just not ready yet. But I think there in Micah, God says, no, no, no. Go help someone. Go do justice. Go show mercy. And this is where the church needs to step in. Because we need to go out and we need to listen to people and we need to be with them. Because I think people are afraid to come to us so often and tell us about things because they're afraid of judgment. And they're afraid of just being kind of brushed off. And sometimes I think they're rightfully afraid of those things, because I think the church in a lot of ways has a track record of that. But I think that we need to go out there and we need to listen and we need to acknowledge and we need to tell them, you have a right to be angry. To the student who went through so much, she has a right to be upset. She has a right to ask questions. That was in my systematic class, and one of my other classes while I've been at Carson Newman, one of my professors suggested the book Night by Elie Wiesel. If you don't know about this book, Elie Wiesel was a survivor of the Holocaust. And I highly suggest this book. I read it one day, and the thing that I really took away from that book was Elie Wiesel. He says he refuses to acknowledge that God saved him in the Holocaust. He refuses to say God saved him. Because if he says that God saved him, he has to acknowledge why God didn't save everyone else. If he acknowledges that God saved him, he has to answer the question, why did God not save the people who died? And I think he has the right to answer that question, to ask that question. And I don't know what the answer is, because I do believe that God is active in this world, and I do believe that God reaches into history and redeems. But I don't have an answer for him. And I'm afraid that if somebody in our church, not in our country, in our world, if somebody asks that question, that so often people would be like, eh, don't worry about it. It's fine. Just trust God. Just give it to God. It's fine. Move on. But these questions have a right to be asked. God is there, and God is mysterious, and this world is difficult. And there's so many questions that we have and so much pain that we feel. And I think God is there with us in that pain. And God is sitting there saying, yeah, this evil, it's bad. And I think God sits with us there in the pain and then works with us, but not before acknowledging that pain. And as many of you know, I work here at Providence with the students and the children primarily. And I think there's some pretty direct application here with children and students and even college students. Because with all my wisdom of not being a teenager for 3 years at this point, and I'm almost done with college, so I can almost analyze a college experience and talk about those kind of things. And I haven't been a child. I'm married now, so some people tell me that means I'm not a child anymore, and I say, okay, that works. But I think a lot of the times when a teenager or when a student or when a college student or any of those things come to us and tell us about their problems, we say, oh yeah, high school. I wish I had those days again. Or, oh yes, college. Man, if only I had those problems again. Let me tell you about my problems. And we just brush away these things that they're going through. Because let me tell you, Jesus in this story is abandoned by his friends, and It's not a solitary experience for Jesus. In my time at Carson Newman, I've gone through times where I've had lots of friends, and I've had times where I've had not as many friends as I had at one other point. I've had times where there was one week where I was talking with someone, and we were talking about when we got older and what we would do and how we would be friends for a long time, and how when Ashley and I, if/when we have kids, that they would call this person aunt, and when this person had kids, they could call Ashley and I aunt and uncle, and how great that would be, and how we would go visit each other. And then 2 weeks later, that person said, never mind, and walked away. They said, this friendship's not working out for me. I'm done. I'll see you later. And I said, all right. And there were some people I talked to about this, and they said, man, that's awful. Man, that hurts. And I said, yeah, it hurts. And then there were some people I talked to about this, and they said, man, college is crazy. And they walked away. And I said, all right, well, thanks for that. And there's sometimes that you talk to people about things like that, and they say, well, at least you have God, right? I say, yeah, I'm glad I have God, and I'm glad I'm a Christian, but that doesn't mean this isn't the worst thing. And they say, yeah, you're fine. You'll move on. And I think this is something we do all the time with our kids and with our students and with the people around us, is if we've gone through that problem younger, we say, ah, you'll get through it. And we don't acknowledge that deep pain they're in that moment. I think this is something the church can get better at. And some of you may be sitting here today and be saying like, yeah, I'm already pretty good at that. I already acknowledge and good. I'm so glad. But I think that a lot of the times we we're not so good at it, and we just kind of brush people off as we go about our way. Because you see here at the end of this passage, Jesus tells the disciples to watch and pray. And this isn't the only time that we've heard this in the Bible, because Paul kind of picks up these two words in his ethics all through his writings. He is constantly telling people to watch and to pray. And I think that's what we should walk away here with. I think we should walk away remembering that we need to watch and we need to pray. We need to watch. We need to make sure that when somebody comes to us and they say, tell us of their pain, that we don't fall asleep, that we don't walk away unaffected. We need to make sure that we're awake in the first place. We need to make sure that we're not sitting here in our nice little bubble and not talking to anyone outside of it, hoping that no one will find us and tell us about the hard things they're going through. We need to make sure that we're awake and that we stay awake and we're aware of the things going on around us. And I think second, we need to pray. I think when I say we need to pray, I mean literally we need to pray. I mean that we need to talk to God about all this. Because that's what Jesus did. Again, if we're in here, if we're reading this and talking about what Jesus did and how that relates to us, I think first we can see Jesus felt sorrow. And so I think that means that we can feel sorrow. But I think the second thing we can see is that when Jesus was in the most pain of his life, he prayed. He talked to God. When Jesus had nowhere else to turn, he turned to God. And I think that's where we need to turn as well. I think we need to pray. But also when I say we need to pray, I think we need to pray with others. Because that's what Jesus asks of his disciples here. He says, pray with me. Pray with me. Be here with me in this pain. Please don't walk away. And the disciples just can't quite handle it. So I think that we need to pray to God. We need to ask God to interact in our world, to intervene, to be here. We need to acknowledge that the pain the people are in is valid, and they have a right to feel that pain. And I think we need to be there with them in that pain and understand what they're saying. And I think we need to, before we start telling them to just go ahead and yank that nail out of their forehead, that yes, the nail is there, and I can't imagine how painful that must be for you. Because when we knock on that door and we sit down on that person's couch, the first thing we say is, you'll be okay, or just move on, or anything like that, we just lost that conversation. Because that person is in pain, and they need someone to tell them, yes, I see you. Yes, I understand you. And so as you go today, I ask that you watch and you pray. You watch and you pray with the people around you, and that you meet new people, that as you watch, that leads you to new people that you can continue to pray with. Because there is so much pain in our world. We could go through and we could talk about every different aspect of suffering and of pain and of grief that's going on, but I think you guys know, I think so many people in this room have experienced a lot of that. And you know what that pain is, and there's no need for us to go through it. And I think we know that there are people around us who are feeling those things. And I just ask that you be with them and you tell them, I'm here with you. I'm going to pray for us. Lord, you do so much for us, God. You sent Jesus to die for us, and so often we forget. You are here with us in our pain. You are here with us in our sorrow and our suffering. And you're just there with us, God, even when we don't know it. I pray that as we go from here today, that you will show us those around us who need you, God, and that you will lead us to be there with them. We thank you for who you are, and we love you. In your name I pray. Amen.